and welcome to Season 3 of the Hopkins Press Podcast. My name is Rain Alexander, and I'm the Senior Publicist for the Journals Division of Johns Hopkins University Press. I'm excited to bring you this new series of interviews with authors and editors about some of the fascinating work that appears in the pages of our journals, 110 academic journals and counting. We're beginning this season in conversation with Gabriela Lee, a faculty member at the University of the Philippines who teaches creative writing and children's literature and who is currently pursuing her PhD in English at the University of Pittsburgh. Gabriela Lee is also a prize-winning author with several published collections of short stories. Her most recent collection, A Playlist for the End of the World, was nominated for a National Book Award in the Philippines. You can read more about her work and pick up her books through her website, sundialgirl.com. Gabriela Lee's recent article in Children's Literature Association Quarterly, When the Shoe Doesn't Fit, Reading Cinderella as Colonial Children's Literature in the Philippines, investigates the Cinderella myth. You know the story. A humble working girl whose fairy godmother arranges it so she gets to go to the ball, meets Prince Charming, leaves behind a glass slipper. He searches the countryside for her until they are reunited. It's a myth that appears in many versions in many countries. Gabriela Lee's article in the summer 2023 edition of Children's Literature Association Quarterly traces the ways this myth was introduced to children in the Philippines as an English language colonial project, yet over time the story became adapted to suit the search for a Philippine national identity. We recently shared this article on the Hopkins Press social media platforms. And if you're not already, please follow us on all of them, Facebook, Twitter, Blue Sky, Threads, Instagram, Mastodon, even LinkedIn. And when we shared the article, it went semi-viral, garnering hundreds of likes and shares on Facebook alone, much more than a typical article share gets. And of course, that caught our attention. To accompany the release of this podcast, we'll once again make the article freely available for readers for a short period of time so that everyone can read along. So with no further ado, let's talk with Gabriela Lee about her hit article, When the Shoe Doesn't Fit, Reading Cinderella as Colonial Children's Literature in the Philippines. Gabriela, welcome to the Hopkins Press Podcast.
Hello, thank you so much for having me here.
A pleasure to have you here. And we're relaunching the podcast with you, which I'm very excited to do. And the reason that I wanted to talk with you to relaunch it is that a few weeks ago, we publicized your article on the Hopkins Press social media outlets, and it kind of went viral. We're used to seeing, you know, a few likes and shares, you know, maybe a couple dozen for a really popular post, but you got hundreds and hundreds of likes and shares, especially on Facebook, which was marvelous to see. And it seemed to kind of break out of the academic sphere a little bit. And I wonder if you have any speculation as to why that might have been.
Well, I mean, part of my field is speculative fiction. So I guess that's one of the first things. I guess, first of all, I have to clarify that I'm not on Facebook a lot. Like, I have an account, but I haven't opened it in a few months. So so when you first came to me and mentioned this particular fact, I was very surprised. This isn't the first time I've been published academically, but I don't recall anything I've written previously also gaining this kind of online attention. And so that was a surprise for me too. But the more I thought about it, to a certain extent, it made sense for three reasons, at least in my mind. The first is most of Philippine academia is on Facebook. It is the social media platform of choice. Mostly because Facebook is free in the Philippines. And so especially for those who live in places where internet access might not be as reliable and it's more difficult to just get the signal and things like that, like Facebook became essentially your digital third space in Philippine academia. So most academics I know do maintain a Facebook presence more than, say, on Twitter or Instagram or Blue Sky, wherever. I guess that's why it circulated very quickly. The second was it's free. I think it was made free for a brief period of time. Again, going back to access, not a lot of our institutions subscribe to, say, Project Muse. Again, mostly because of access or like funding. And we all know that to a certain extent, the humanities is usually the first one that gets hit with any kind of budget cut, and that includes any kind of digital repository, much like Project Muse and JSTOR and these kinds of very useful platforms that disseminate information but are also expensive to maintain or to keep track of. So the fact that it was free, I think, was also part of why it circulated quickly. And the third is, I think, because at least in my little corner of Philippine academia, the humanities and creative writing and literature, we don't normally get a platform in journals outside of area studies. So Philippine studies usually, or Southeast Asian studies. So we don't usually find purchase outside of these kinds of the geographical areas, at least for journals. So that plus the fact that children's literature is underexplored academic territory, I guess that was most probably the reason why it spread very quickly online.
Yeah, that's so cool. So really briefly, this is an article which traces the ways that the Cinderella myth was imported into the Philippines as a colonial project, but then through a couple of channels became useful as an establishment of a Philippine national identity, which I think is a fascinating trajectory. What prompted you to write this piece, and how does it fit in with your larger body of work?
Oh, thank you. This wasn't just me. I wanted to quickly point out that it wasn't just me who did this on my own. So I am indebted to four academic mentors who helped forward this particular project. Obviously, Dr. Jill Costi, who was the special editor of this particular journal issue of Children's Literature Quarterly, was instrumental in just helping me develop the way I thought of this, what started as a conference presentation to it towards the full article. So she was the one who kind of helped me think through editorially from draft up until the version that we see right now. And I was also helped out by Dr. Nicole Constable over at the University of Pittsburgh, because she held an academic writing workshop class in which this first began transforming, let's say, from just ideas in my head into something that I was able to write down. And then obviously the children's literature and childhood studies area over at the English department here at the University of Pittsburgh, especially with Dr. Courtney Weichel Mills and Dr. Tyler Bickford, who encouraged me along the way and helped me with sources. But it was Dr. Weichel Mills who engendered this paper, because she was the one who invited me for the conference presentation that started this all in 2020. So she invited me as part of a panel she was putting together with the SHCY, so Society for the History of Children and Youth. She invited me to present anything that I was interested in, but she generally had a theme of global mapping circuits of children's literature. So I thought about this project as tying into a larger research question that I had been kind of pursuing for a while, which is basically how Philippine children's literature was influenced by external literary trends or movements or context. And in the presentation that I did for the conference, I talked more about global mapping. How do you trace these kinds of influences? How do you tease them out? And because when we talk about influence, especially literary influence, obviously it's very amorphous, and it's very much just trying to look at hints of how they might have appeared in finished products, such as books and primers and all of that. In that conference paper, which was, I think, just like 15 slides long, probably I just did slides for it and notes. I talked more about not just Cinderella, but a couple of other stories that kind of came from what we think of as the golden age or the children's canon, essentially, and how they might have influenced stories in the Philippines. whether it's Philippine authors, or the way that they appear, the way they transform for a Philippine audience. And so, because a lot of my work is situated at the intersections of Philippine literature and English, children's literature and speculative fiction, this project kind of hit on all of those three interests, but also became essentially what was my first exploration into more historical sources and context that led me to doing this PhD. So yeah, that's essentially how a convoluted way of getting there.
Yeah, but you're working your way through it as academia and academics kind of tend to do, right? Well, you talk in the article about the development of a Filipino children's literary canon and a lot through fairy tales and folk tales. Can you describe that more fully and how Cinderella fits in? Like, are there other fairy tales that function similarly to Cinderella, or do you think there's something unique to that narrative that strikes a chord in the Philippines?
Oh, I mean, that's such a wonderful question. I don't think I am the be all end all of saying whether of this the development of a Philippine children's literary canon. Certainly, there are canonical texts that we consider to be the, I guess, the genesis of, if you're tracing it historically, the genesis of where we might pinpoint where a formal label such as Philippine children's literature would have started. And that's certainly part of what I'm working on right now for my graduate degree, is essentially what might that mean? What might that term actually mean in the first place? There are a few chapters in books and so forth that imply that there are titles that are firmly considered to be part of Philippine children's literary canon. So, like, for instance, the Philippine national hero Jose Rizal, who lived at the tail end of the 19th century, is widely regarded to be the author of the first Philippine children's book or story, The Monkey and the Turtle, which was published in, oh gosh, I'm going to get dates wrong, in the 1860s or 1870s. But I know that it was published in a publication called Crumner's Oriental Record in London. And I know that he wrote this story called The Monkey and the Turtle, which was based on existing folklore coming from the northern parts of the Philippines in Ilocos. And he wrote a version of it for his nieces and nephews, and he illustrated it himself. And he also translated some of Hans Christian Andersen's work into Tagalog, as well as a couple of other myths and legends, essentially. And The Monkey and the Turtle is considered the first Philippine children's book, it both in terms of its form, because it was illustrated and had text with it, and it was intended for his younger relatives, essentially, for his nieces and nephews. And that's actually even the basis when this was published contemporarily. This is when we celebrate Philippine National Children's Book Day, which is every third Tuesday in July, in
Cool.
celebration of Dr. Rizal's contribution. So yeah, so like that's an example of what could be considered canon children's literature in the Philippines. But even before then, as far as I was able to ascertain, there were already Cinderella stories, or what could have been classified as Cinderella stories, prior to the American colonial period, except they weren't obviously called Cinderella stories at that time, because it was by word of mouth, and it was only recorded by American anthropologists when they came over to the Philippines as part of this bigger colonial project with, like, the benevolent assimilation, etc. So they also went around the Philippines collecting folk tales, and that was the first, probably the first time that these stories were actually written down, comparatively speaking. So that's why I think the first print version of it was in the early 1900s. I believe it's 1904, 1903, simply because they weren't written down. And so there was no, like, traceable records of them.
this isn't in the questions that I sent you over,
Yeah.
but yeah, I'm thinking now to the beginning of that article where you're kind of differentiating these two paths, these two kinds of Cinderella stories, the cat skin.
Yes.
There's like the cat skin version,
Yeah.
and then the other version.
The Cendrillon, I think it was the Cendrillon version of it. Yeah.
Do the pre-colonial narratives kind of fit into that divergent structure?
They hew more closely in terms of the, at least the ones I was able to find. Just as an aside, one of the most interesting things that came out of this article being on Facebook and being widely circulated was I've had a couple of colleagues from the Philippines actually get in touch with me and go, "Oh, we also have a version of this in our regional language." Because obviously the Philippines has like 100 something languages. I only speak two. So, and a lot of them are not in translation. So that also came out of that conversation was, "Oh, we also have a version in our regional language of this story." Or, "Oh, I've also heard that there's a version of this." But obviously, it's never been translated into English, or it's not been accessible to a wider audience. So that was an interesting result, I think, of the article receiving wider circulation.
Rereading the article this morning in preparation for the podcast, I noticed one of the common components of the two variations on the Cinderella myth that you talk about is that the mother or godmother figure appears as a crab before becoming a tree. And immediately, because I've been doing other reading, we publish across a lot of disciplines, right? And so I had been doing some other reading about this evolutionary notion that species tend to evolve towards crabs. And so, of course, my mind is like, this is amazing.
Yeah.
And I kind of wonder, do crabs have a significant place in myth and legend in the Philippines?
Oh yes, definitely. Like across the archipelago, crabs are one of the more common animals that we see in myths and legends. I think partially because the Philippines is an archipelago, so we're surrounded by water. So one of our more common industries is obviously fishery. And also, if you travel across the Philippines, there are many, many regions that have some kind of culinary dish involving crabs. So on the one hand, very delicious, but also appears a lot in our story. So like there is, I think I mentioned it in the article, and I hope I am pronouncing the name right because I am not Mandaya. But Tambanocano, or the giant crab from Mandaya folklore. So the Mandaya is an indigenous group in the southern part of the Philippines, and part of their cosmology is this giant crab that tries to swallow the moon. And there's another story named Batak, or the Titanic crab somewhere in the northern part of the, so very, this very different like indigenous groups. This one comes from, I believe, the Bontoc tribe, which again is another indigenous group, this time up north. Again, a giant crab that causes earthquakes whenever it goes in and out of its hole, like in the ocean. So the crab itself seems to play a large part in various cosmologies of indigenous groups in the Philippines. I'm pretty sure there's more. This is just the two that I can think of right now. So to me, it wasn't surprising that oh, of course the fairy godmother is the crab in these stories. But again, going through the editorial process, Dr. Costi was like, "Oh, you have to explain this," because, and again, that was one of the great things about working with an editor, a journal editor, is they kind of help you craft towards an audience. And so in this case, she was like, "You have to explain this, and you have to clarify why this is important that you're highlighting this." Because to me, it made sense as a Filipino, like, okay, of course, this.
Sure.
Yeah, I have no questions about why it's a crab. And then she's like, "No, but you have to understand your audience is not just Filipinos. It's going to go to a wider audience. So now you have to explain it." And I'm like, "Oh, okay, I understand."
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's great. That's really great.
Yeah.
One of the terms that you use extensively in this article, or several times in this article, is glocal, GLOCAL, and glocalization. And this is a relatively new term to me. I think it was a fascinating concept. It's one of those moments where I'm like, oh, there's a word for something that makes sense that I didn't realize, was a thing that I was even thinking about. And so that was an exciting moment of revelation for me. Can you talk a little bit about your relationship to this word idea and its meaningfulness in your work?
Oh, sure. Thank you for highlighting that. So the term glocalization, I actually picked it up from another scholar's work, Ana Catrina Gutierrez, who is also Filipino, in her book titled Mixed Magic, Global and Local Dialogues in Fairy Tales for Young Readers. It's very helpful in the ways that I was thinking about Cinderella. And she actually does also talk about Cinderella in her book, but she talks more about the Disney version and also more contemporary versions, whereas my direction went more historical. I did pull the quote from it so that I could put it more succinctly. So she writes about it in her book, Mixed Magic. It's a term that she took from Roland Robertson. Let me just quote what she says about this. Glocalization occurs as a process of creation rather than competition between the dominant and domestic spheres. This interaction based on cultural borrowing produces expressions of glocal hybridity that cannot simply be described in terms of sameness or difference. Recognizing the interplay between unifying contexts and diversifying elements reveals paradoxical pressures between international and national spaces, such that cooperation exists at the same time as conflict, as do order and disorder, inclusion and exclusion, modern and traditional, end quote. So to me, that was such a useful definition as I was thinking through this project, because I didn't want to just present a binary of, oh, this is the colonial version of Cinderella, and this is the traditional or pre-colonial version of Cinderella. And then there are two separate Cinderellas that don't meet in the middle. And I was more interested in the ways that they influence each other. And I think that's part of what was interesting about the two versions that I was able to excavate and talk about, the version from Camilo Osias's Primer, but also the translated version from Severina Reyes, which is one of a number of translations of Mariang Alimango. So I just used the English translation of it that was circulating currently. So I find it useful that Gutierrez talked about the process of interplay or the process of intermingling as opposed to separation. Because I also think that's part of both the creative process, but also what comes out of it. And it's useful to describe the currents of influence in children's literature production, especially outside the global north, where we're still reckoning with both colonial influences and with the intention that children are meant to be reading them primarily. So I thought that glocalization was such a useful term to describe that process and to describe that way of how these forces move towards each other. And I find that it's also useful because she does talk about both unifying context and diversifying elements. And I think that's part of what the bigger project of that special issue of the journal is about, is asking what does children's canon mean outside the global north, outside the Anglosphere? What does having a canon, if it even exists, what does that mean? And what kind of stories have come out of that? So to me, it was a very succinct and useful way of thinking about the project.
Well, I'm hoping that everybody's going to read this article because it's really fascinating. It's really
Thank you.
accessible and very enlightening. So I'm hoping that this will drive more and more people to look at your work. Do you want to
Thank
talk
you.
about what you're working on next?
Sure. So I'm working on a dissertation, which is essentially tracing the speculative elements and influences that have affected Philippine children's literature and trying to do like a social and historical contextualization of what that might mean and mapping essentially the colonial imaginary and how that influenced Philippine children's literature, but also how it kind of speaks back. So the colonial and the post-colonial and the decolonial in kind of conversation with each other through Philippine children's literature. So that's obviously an ongoing project. I'm working on with a number of other scholars, including Dr. Lara Sagisag and Dr. Marilita Jimenez, on a forum article about children's literature under the long shadow of US imperialism, which we're hoping to put together this year. And I'm working on a literary encyclopedia article on Philippine children's literature as well. That's with Dr. Danny Bernstein over at University of Illinois. And I have a couple of short stories in the works.
In
So
your spare time.
on top of everything else, why not throw in that? So
Indeed, indeed. Well, this
yes.
has been great, and I hope we can have you back on the podcast after you've put some of this stuff into print and see what you do next.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate being part of this.
Thank you for listening to the Hopkins Press podcast interview with Gabriella Lee. To read more about her work and pick up copies of her books, please visit her website at sundialgirl.com. Links to her website and her article in Children's Literature Association Quarterly are available in the podcast information page of the Hopkins Press website, press.jhu.edu/multimedia. The music featured in today's episode is by Jean Toba, which you can find on the Free Music Archive, and that is also linked at the podcast information page. Thanks for listening, and we hope to see you next time on the Hopkins Press Podcast.